You're listening to All the Books, a weekly show of recommendations and enthusiasm regarding the week's new book releases. This is episode 461, and today we are talking about books being released on May 7th, 2024, and more. I'm Liberty Hardy, here with Danica Ellis, and we're coming to you from bookriot.com. Danica, hello!
Hello! How are you doing?
Oh, busy, as usual. Yeah. Everything is chaos, you know. I'm like, hey, how about we record here, or here, or how about now, or what about now? Yeah, just chaos. But that's okay. It's beautiful here in Maine. There's lots of creatures. The Orioles are here now. Like, I never get tired of seeing them. They're just so amazing. It's probably like a bunch of different ones, but since I only see one at a time, I keep thinking it's like the same one.
Yeah.
It's probably like several of them, but that's cool. We have a raccoon now that visits at night, and he walks up our porch steps. He walks up our porch steps and goes into the backyard. And then he leaves by the stairs too, like, thank you, see you tomorrow, which is hilarious.
That sounds adorable.
Yeah. But yeah, so what's going on that side? You were telling me about something so cool that I had never heard of that I'm super jealous that I'm on the East Coast right now.
Yeah, I am going to, every year, my city holds this giant book sale for charity where all the books are, well, it's usually been $1 to $3. I think they might have upped it to $2 to $4 this year. But they sell hundreds of thousands of books. I think they got to a million one year, but definitely hundreds of thousands. Yeah, it's just they hold it in a curling club because this is Canada. They just have tables with boxes of books, and then under the tables are stacks of more boxes of books. So if you're really serious about it, like, you'll be, you know, trying to dig under the table through just stacks and stacks of books. And yeah, it's always, I used to go for the bookstore I worked for. I would go looking in the kids section, trying to find the really valuable kids books mixed in. And it was like a treasure hunt. And I do miss doing that because it's so fun to just be looking through thousands of books, looking for the gems hidden in there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I can't even figure out the logistics.
Yeah, like,
how do they get all the books in there and then get them out? Like, I mean, I guess they don't, because people buy them, so I guess that technically moves them out of the building.
They're always left with a lot at the end that don't sell, so they have to. I think there's like a company they sell them all to, like, kind of wholesale.
Probably.
But yeah, it's a huge operation. It used to be that they would, it's the newspaper here that does it. And it used to be that they would collect books like all through the year, but then they got way too many books. So now they only collect books for one weekend. It's 2 days. And they, in that 2 days, people come by with hundreds of thousands of books.
That's bananas. Ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's intense.
I wonder what like the percentage of people who read in that area is compared to like other
areas. We're definitely a book city. We've got lots of bookstores, so yeah, I think it's pretty reader heavy.
That's very cool.
And people line up. There are people who camp out the night before at the door waiting for it to open. Like, people show up, I think at midnight or something, and set up a little tent on the sidewalk and wait to get in.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't doubt it. Like, my mother was a librarian, you know, for most of my childhood, and they would have the library book sale, you know, and people would line up, you know, 3, 4, or 5 hours early, know, and they would have, like, you know, no problem knocking a small child to the ground to get what they wanted, you know, but I don't apologize. That small child deserved it. But yeah, it was just, it was wild. So I can only imagine like what this must be like.
Yeah, there's a line like around the block by the time they open the doors. Yeah. Oh, man. It used to be terrible when I did the kids section. They used to have it in the basement, and it was just this tiny little cramped room. And it was absolutely just you were shoulder to shoulder with people. And then there were just like kids running around your ankles.
Amazing. Like,
it was, yeah, it was a lot. Wow.
Well, before we talk more about books and children and other things, we're going to hear from a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Diana Dixon has a busy summer and no time for tall, gorgeous hockey player Shane's shenanigans. Because you know what? If they shenan once, they'll shenan again. So she thinks she knows exactly who he is when he moves into her apartment building, but turns out Shane's sick of hookups and tired of being on the rebound after his long-term girlfriend called it quits. But when his ex comes back into the picture, he needs a plan. And who better to play his new girlfriend than his sassy new neighbor? So a fake relationship might be perfect for Diana's own ex issues, but Diana is used to living by the rules. Will she learn that when it comes to love, rules are meant to be broken? Make sure to check out The Dixon Rule by L. Kennedy. L. Kennedy is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author with over a million copies of her books sold. So this is going to be another banger, y'all. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Gallery Books. So Anna Green thought she was marrying Liam West for access to subsidized family housing while at UCLA, which is an interesting reason to marry someone, but you know, in this economy. So anyway, she signed divorce papers when the graduation caps were tossed and she thought she was done. She wasn't. 3 years later, Anna is a starving artist living paycheck to paycheck while West is a Stanford professor. Now, he is part of a conglomerate. His family owns this mega grocery store chain. He's not interested in working for them, but he is interested in those greenbacks, honey, that come in the form of a $100 million inheritance. To get it, he has to be married for 5 years. That's where our girl Anna comes back into play. So the two will fake a marriage, but as he gets to know her and gets to appreciate the feisty, foul-mouthed, paint-splattered girl that she is, he'll begin to wonder if the money is worth the love of his life. Pick up The Paradise Problem by Christina Lauren to find out if it is. And thanks again to Gallery Books for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, so that's great. So this is basically like the Taylor Swift concert of book sales.
Yes,
is what you're saying.
It's
that's
a big
pretty
deal.
Amazing. Yeah, wow, I'm wicked jealous. And yes, I know I said wicked. Every time I say wicked, somebody like messages me or sends an email and is like, "You said wicked." It's like, yes, I'm from New England. I say wicked. I like it. I think it's great.
Yeah.
So. All right. Before I tell you about my first pick for today, I want to tell you that one, today is a general purpose area code corresponding episode number 461. Those are, it's like getting tired. It's like not as much fun. It's like, okay, already. Like, let's have something fun. But I also want to remind you that Mother's Day is coming up. So if you are looking for a great Mother's Day gift, something a little different, you know, go beyond flowers and chocolate. You can give the gift of reading with tailored book recommendations. Our bibliologists are standing by to help your mom or whoever you want to give it to find their next great read, their favorite, next favorite read, and it's delivered right to their inbox or doorstep. And with gifts starting at just $18, there's something for every budget. So head to mytbr.co/gift to send the gift of reading to the book nerd in your life. That's mytbr.co/gift. All right, my first pick for today is The Ministry of Time by Callie-Ann Bradley. This is a great speculative debut, and I really enjoy this book. But I don't think that it fit any of the labels that were attached to it. Like all the things that I was told about this book, I was like, no. But I'm going to tell you a bit about the book, but I can't tell you too much because I don't want to spoil anything. And then I'll explain to you like why I didn't think some of these labels fit. It is set in a near future England, and it has an unnamed narrator who is a civil servant and is now working as a bridge. And I'll explain to you what that means in just a second here. But here's the plan. The government has retrieved several people from history through the use of time travel and brought them to the present day to see if time travel is possible and to see if people can exist outside their own time, like how they adapt to this drastic change. They go back and basically they open this like weird blue door of electricity and lasso these people and pull them into their time. So they're from several different centuries, and it's not with their permission, I will say. Like, they're taking these people, you know, who by all accounts have been dead for a very long time now in present day in this book, and bringing them into the 21st century. And the narrator, as I said, is a bridge. A bridge is a person who goes between the government and what they call an expat. And she is, each bridge, there's five of them, is assigned an expat. And hers is Commander Graham Gore. Now, most of you are like, okay, possibly one or two of you is like, wait a second, wasn't that a real person? Yes, he was a real person. He was part of the doomed Franklin Arctic Expedition. If you have seen The Terror or read The Terror by Dan Simmons, it is about the ships, The Terror and the other two, get stuck in the ice, and 179 men, I think, disappeared. Nobody knows, like, what happened. Well, I mean, they know some of them died, they were sick, they were injured, you know, they were starving, but they don't really know what happened to the rest of them. Probably not a murderous bear spirit, like in the book. Spoiler alert, but, you know, or maybe they don't know what happened to them, so maybe there was one, but Graham Gore was a real person. He was actually a wildly interesting person. His father got him work on a ship when he was only 11 years old, and he was rarely on land after that, and like I said, he died in this expedition along with everybody. Anyway, so they kidnapped this guy, bring him to the 21st century. So now the bridge and Commander Gore have to live together for a year. He's not really allowed at first to go out on his own. He's not really, you know, he doesn't know anything really about the 21st century. And so she's teaching him, you know, and aside from a few things that really confound him, he's adjusting pretty well. Obviously, it's a lot to take in, but he, you know, they keep taking him to the facility and testing him and looking at his brain and making sure like he's not going to die of some disease that we didn't have back then, or, you know, just something is going to go wrong because of time travel. And you know, he's very charming and he's funny, and soon their bridge expat situation turns into something more meaningful. But this is the government we're talking about, and it will become apparent that the reasoning behind this experiment is not what they claimed it would be, and the bridge is going to have to make some difficult decisions about their future. So that's the gist. Like, sounds really cool, right? And it is. I really enjoyed it. I'm going to keep saying that to you because now I'm going to, you know, say some things. But like, first, like, I was told this book was a cozy. Like, I don't know why it was labeled a cozy. While there's not like a whole lot of gore or sex or profanity, there is some, you know, and some other things that I'll mention in the content warnings. So I wouldn't label this a cozy. It's labeled as a romance. They're pitching it as a romance, but I don't know if I would call it a romance. There is some romance, but the bridge's mother was Cambodian. And I think that if the person you fall for first has to be brought up to date on how to treat you as a woman, and also not to use horrible slurs and other terms commonly used in his day before you start to fall for him, like, that just seems like a lot of work and not very romantic. It's not like a super meet cute. So I don't know. I don't see it as a romance. But, you know, there is some romance. Not that he was malicious, but, you know, in Gore's day, he would have treated the bridge differently. And so while he's certainly on board, like, for correcting his language and stuff, you know, it's just, I wouldn't call it a romance. And it's also being billed as a spy thriller. And I know you're going, this doesn't sound like you enjoyed it, Liberty. And I totally did. I'm just these labels, I don't know. This is in no way a condemnation, because I did really enjoy this book, but it doesn't have much of a spy plot, and it doesn't move at a fast clip, really, at all. Which I didn't mind, you know. But I think people who read the publisher description of this book are going to be very confused as to why they picked it up for these various reasons, and then it doesn't. I mean, it's just my opinion, maybe, but I don't think it meets up to these labels. I think because it's such a unique novel, it's hard to classify it. My first instinct is to call it a speculative adventure. But I mean, I really liked it. It's original and it's funny and it's smart. And the thing with the expats learning about modern day things like the internet and Spotify, you know, is really fun. It's a bit like when they bring, you know, Socrates and the rest to the future in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. You know, and Napoleon learns about bowling. Like, it's great. And it's very similar to Peng Shepherd and Emily St. John Mandel. It's great. And again, this is just my opinion, but I think people should read it and find out for themselves, but just don't be surprised when it doesn't do some of the things it says in the blurb. Was that cranky? Did that sound cranky? I hope not. But I promise, I really did enjoy it. So, content warnings include racism and racial slurs, sexism, death, loss of a loved one, forced institutionalization, because the expats are held against their will after they're kidnapped for many months before they're let out, medical procedures, loss of a loved one, I already said that one, violence, injury, murder, cannibalism, and animal death, including mention of the deaths of a pet dog and a pet cat, lots of hunted animals, and an unfortunate incident involving a bunch of squirrels. That is The Ministry of Time by Callie Ann Bradley, which I promise I really did like.
I think it is so true, though, that how a book is marketed, if that's inaccurate, I think that's the biggest way that something ends up getting a low rating
on
Goodreads, is if just the marketing made you think it was going to be a different genre or tone of book. So I think that's a good reader service to say it's a good book, but it's not exactly the book they described it as.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously reading is subjective.
Yeah.
You know, and I haven't slept in days. And so this is, but like, I think it's pretty somewhat true, these things about the labels. So
yeah,
I'll stop now. Your turn.
All right. My book I want to talk about first is The Library Thief by Kuchenga Shenje. This is about Florence, who is a 19-year-old woman in Victorian England, and she has just been thrown out of her house by her father, who is a bookbinder, after he found her in a compromising position with a young man. So she has one chance to save herself, and that is through intercepting a letter from a client of her father's. So he has a home library that he wants to sell the client, but first he needs the book repaired. All of the books that are falling apart that need new bindings, he needs all of them repaired so that it can sell for a lot more. So Florence has learned from her father. She has bookbinding skills. So she shows up at Lord Francis Belfield's doorstep, and she claims that her father has sent her there to complete this task in his stead. And Lord Belfield is pretty skeptical of that, because this isn't really something women do at this time. But she proves that she has the skills, and also, most importantly, agrees to work for a lot less money than her father would have, as long as she can stay at his estate while she works on the books. So he agrees, and that is a great victory for her. She now has a place to stay, but now she has to navigate this delicate hierarchy of Rose Hall, because she doesn't really fit in with Lord Belfield or his really cruel, awful brother, or the sister-in-law who is quite haughty and thinks of herself as above her. But she's also not supposed to be the same class as the help. So she's trying to distance herself from the cook and the last remaining servant in this household. So she's kind of stuck in between. And then meanwhile, Florence can't help but be intrigued by the mystery of the recent death of Lord Belfield's wife. So his wife is supposed to have drowned on a nighttime walk, but that seems pretty unlikely. No one really knows why she was out there or how she fell into the river. So maybe someone pushed her. And Florence becomes really obsessed with this question. So she risks her safety at Rose Hall by sneaking around at night and reading the late Lady of Persephone's letters. And despite herself, she also ends up developing this close relationship with Wesley, the servant, who sneaks into her room at night to braid and oil her hair. And that's kind of how they end up becoming really close and gossiping and having this great friendship. This is one of those books where the description on the back includes things that don't come up in the novel until like halfway through, sometimes three quarters of the way through. So I'm not really sure how much I should mention because we haven't even gotten to the library theft that the title references, but that doesn't come up until later. So I don't know. I think a lot of people are saying this is a mystery. I don't know if I would categorize it as a mystery. Obviously, there is a strong mystery element, but that isn't as much of the focus as just Florence discovering herself as a person and trying to survive on her own and find where she fits in. This has a lot of secrets and scandals that are revealed over the course of the book. Some of the early Goodreads reviews were scandalized by this book being too, quote, woke, which I would like to say that history wasn't all straight, cis, and white. So I think this is a more diverse cast than people expected picking it up. It kind of looks like a category of historical fiction that you're probably familiar with. You know, the kind of historical fiction where you just see a woman from behind on the cover. So I think people thought they knew what they were getting when they picked it up, and it's a little bit different from that. Florence is progressive, definitely, but her reasoning and her reference points for that are all time period specific. So she's talking about the trial of Oscar Wilde, which is something that is specific to that time period. So I think even though her views are progressive, that it makes sense because those are things people will be thinking about and talking about. The Library Thief doesn't have a queer main character, but it is a pretty queer book. And the main character is a white passing black woman. And that's also something she doesn't learn until later in the book. She thought she was white, but it is mentioned in the description. And I don't feel like you could call that a spoiler. So I will not consider it a spoiler. I thought this was a really interesting book of historical fiction with a focus on characters who don't necessarily get written about in that genre as much. I do want to give content warnings for racism, racist slurs, rape, and unwanted pregnancy. And that is The Library Thief by Kachenga Shenje.
Okay. My next pick for today is Women and Children First by Alina Grabowski. I was looking up things for this week's releases. I spend several hours a day going through catalogs and looking, reading about books and all stuff. And I noticed the ratings for this book. And it has like outstanding reviews, all the stars. And I was like, well, I need to read this. This was just this morning. And I started reading it. And it's so good that I was like, I need to tell everyone about it, even though I am only about 20% of the way through it, which I'm sure is so frustrating, but I promise it has already hooked me, and I have to tell you because I'm astounded. It's set in a small seaside town in Massachusetts. There are the locals and then the summer people. It is the story of the death of a teenage girl told over the course of the book by 10 different women. Obviously, I don't know this because I haven't read the whole book, but I did read the description. That is what it said. I am assuming each woman has a chapter, but I'm only through the first two voices, but I'm guessing that's how it is. The first chapter is a 16-year-old girl. She is caring for her mother. Her mother has chronic illness and pain, and they can't figure out what is wrong with her, but she spends a lot of her time in bed and taking medication and sleeping and out of it and her father has left them supposedly to help someone out in their family. But he hasn't come back. He gives them money. They use his credit cards, but he is not there himself. She also works at a grocery store with a boy from her class who is just awful to her. She doesn't have a lot of friends. She resents the summer people. I should also warn you right up front that she's having a sexual relationship with a student teacher at her school, which is horrifying. But she, you know, from her point of view, she feels like such an adult, you know, like this is something so adult that she's doing. And it's just devastating. And then the second chapter is about a woman who is at the hospital. Her mother is dying of cancer and she's staying there by her side. And then there will be teachers and mothers and students and friends as the book goes on who give the details of this young woman's death. Not the woman at the beginning, the young girl, but the girl that the book is about as the book goes on. And like I said, it's devastating. And already it sounds like difficult subject matter. But I'm telling you, the writing is so good. I've underlined something on practically every page. Like, that's how good it is. I don't do that very often. The last thing I underlined, let's see here, is since I was a kid, I've been like that. Putting my toes over the edge of the train platform, leaning forward over the mountain ledge, that kind of thing. It feels powerful to be so close to making a bad decision and then not make it. It's just amazing. It's making me super cranky that I had to put it down now that I'm talking about it because I wish I was reading it. But there's nowhere I'd rather be than talking about it here with you. It is Women and Children First by Alina Grabowski. Content warnings so far, obviously, cancer, death of a child, statutory rape, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more, but again, so good.
That sounds really interesting. I hadn't heard of that one.
So I've already mentioned it to two other people who both said the same thing. They're like, I haven't heard anything about this book. And I'm like, I know, me either. And I spend days like looking at these things, but I'm glad that I finally caught on to it because I'm just so impressed.
Well, the next book I want to talk about is The Year of Living Constitutionally by A.J. Jacobs, which is admittedly a very out of left field choice for me, which, you know, since this is the cranky episode, I will say there were so many books out today that I was so excited to read that I started reading and I did not like. There were some of my most anticipated books. And then I got some of them a couple of chapters in, and then I had to stop. One had a little bit of unexpected cannibalism, and I just wasn't feeling it. And then another one I got...
Oh, that's my new band name, Unexpected Cannibalism.
It's like, I know that that'll be a selling point for some people. It just wasn't, yep, wasn't what
gonna,
I wanted.
I'm going to have to ask you after.
Right? And then another one, I finished the whole book. I was really enjoying it until the ending, which I just hated. I hated the ending. So I ended up having to rearrange what I was going to read, which is how I ended up reading a book about the Constitution, which is not something I normally would have picked up, not least of all because I am Canadian. But I really enjoy A.J. Jacobs' audiobooks especially. He narrates them himself, and they're just these sort of conversational, fact-filled books that make the best audiobooks, in my opinion, where you can dip in and out of them. You learn some great, hey, did you know facts to share? It kind of feels like listening to a podcast. So when I saw this was an option for an audiobook review copy, I grabbed it, even though this isn't a subject I would normally pick up. And I'm glad that I did, because despite not being interested in the Constitution, I had a really good time listening to this one. A.J. Jacobs does a lot of these Year of Living XYZ books. So I read his book, The Year of Living Biblically, as a teenager. And that is actually, I wrote a post about the books that changed my life the most and how they weren't necessarily my favorite books of all time. So The Year of Living Biblically, I liked, but it wasn't, you know, something I would put on my favorite shelf necessarily. But that was the book that got me to start tithing, which is not really tithing. It's just setting aside a certain percentage of my income for charity. But I started doing it after I read that book and I never stopped. So it actually changed my life more than almost any other book that I've read. So that's why I picked this one up. And it was a really informative and interesting read. And because of it's A.J. Jacobs, it's not enough to just try to live by the Constitution for a year. He also wants to get into the founders' heads. So he is living as close to a 1700s life as possible, complete with just wearing a tricorn hat around. So I also thought it was really useful to get this overview of the Constitution. He discusses kind of the different camps when it comes to interpreting the Constitution. And it was nice to feel like I at least know the Cliff's Notes version now, because in Canada, we're still very affected by what happens in the US. And so having that working knowledge of the schools of thought around the Constitution is useful. I have to admit that even with all the explanation, I still find it hard to wrap my head around the originalist arguments or how this 1700s piece of paper still has so much power, but it's definitely an improvement over where I started. I definitely know more about it now. And he also works in personal writing, like his experience doing historical reenactments. There's a lot of humor. So I think his books are a great way to learn about something you might not have sat down to study on your own. If you already have a good understanding of the Constitution, how it's interpreted, this might be a little too general to add much for you, but it's still a fun listen. And there's also a lot of weird facts from the history of the Constitution that might be new to you. I think the best audience for it, though, is probably someone like me who is vaguely interested in learning more, but wouldn't have picked up books about it before, or who maybe glazed over that part of history class. So I do recommend it, even though I was kind of surprised I read it. And that's The Year of Living Constitutionally by A.J. Jacobs.
He's fun. I am a big fan of stunt reading.
Yeah.
I haven't done things to that extreme, but I have done like read for 24 hours in the window of the bookstore, or like have yeah. you know, or like read all of these books, or you know, like I'm a fan of that, so like I really enjoy his stuff. And you know,
I have to say that when I wrote that post, I think it's titled something like "The Books That Changed My Life the Most Weren't Very Good" or something like that, which was like a bit of like not a clickbait title, but a bit of an exaggerated title. But then A.J. Jacobs emailed me after I wrote that. It was like, kind of like, thanks. Oh. And I was like, I am sorry. But he was great about it. But I was really embarrassed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you like, know, not I, every I book is for every person.
Right? I'm like, it did change my life. I don't know.
All right. Well, before we talk about more books that might change your life, we're going to hear from a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Avid Reader Press. So this next book is a really fun sounding mashup of different genres. There's a little time travel, a little romance, a little spy thriller action going on. So in the near future, a civil servant is offered the salary of her dreams and is shortly afterward told what project she'll be working on. A recently established government ministry is gathering quote unquote expats from across history to establish whether time travel is feasible for the body, but also for the fabric of space-time. This is an exquisitely original and feverishly fun fusion of genres and ideas. The Ministry of Time by Colleen Bradley asks, what does it mean to defy history when history is living in your house? Colleen Bradley's answer is a blazing, unforgettable testament to what we owe each other in a changing world. It kind of gives Outlander meets Cloud Atlas, or if The Time Traveler's Wife was written by Sally Rooney or Colson Whitehead. Make sure to check out The Ministry of Time by Colleen Bradley. And thanks again to Avid Reader Press for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have 7 great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number 6. So if he is to have 7 great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. My next pick for today is one that I have read. I read like a year ago. So the details are a little hazy in my brain now. But it's called Plain Jane and the Mermaid by Vera Brosgal, who is the author of Anya's Ghost and Be Prepared, which are fabulous middle grade. I think those are both also middle grade graphic novels. This, Plain Jane and the Mermaid, is a middle grade graphic novel. It's set in the late 1800s, possibly the early 1900s, that's the part I'm fuzzy on. But Vera is a teenager. She has no friends. Her parents are cold and distant. She once had a younger brother, but he died in a drowning accident. So she leads kind of this sad and lonely existence. And people are not very nice to her. And then her parents die at the same time. And they were well off, and they lived in this great big house. But because Vera is a girl, she can't legally inherit what is hers, including the very house that she is living in, unless she is married. So instead, her house and everything that her parents had is going to a male relative, her cousin, who is a horrible person and tells Vera, hit the road, you have to get out. And Vera's like, I think I'm going to fight this. So she thinks about it, and one day while she's out, she meets a young man, or I should say, first sees a young man named Peter being bullied by his father. And she can tell that he's unhappy, and so she goes up to him and she says, hey, I have a proposal. You and I get married. It's a marriage of convenience. I get to keep my house, and you get to get away from your dad. And he's like, yes, sure. So this is going to be great. She's going to get to keep her stuff. She can tell her cousin to get lost. But then Peter is kidnapped by a mermaid and dragged into the ocean. You know, like, happens. You hear about that all the time. But Vera is still determined to outwit her cousin. So she finds a way to swim to the bottom of the sea without needing to breathe and dives in to rescue him. And as she's swimming to the bottom of the ocean, she makes friends with a seal. She learns a lot about herself. She has exciting and dangerous escapades because she's swimming around trying to find out who knows where to find this mermaid's lair, this mermaid who has fangs. It's great. It's just so fun. I loved it. The illustrations, like, I love Brosgal's illustrations. They're so pleasing. Like, they're cartoony, but also, like, lovely and colorful. And it's a great story about friendship and loneliness and standing up for yourself. And I've been waiting almost a year to tell you about it because I loved it so much. I do want to tell you that the content warnings include bullying, fat phobia, body shaming, disordered eating, self-injury, non-physical parental abuse, child death, because she loses her baby brother, and sexism. It is Plain Jane and the Mermaid by Vera Brosgal.
I always love when you describe a book as like, here is this kid who everyone she loves dies. And this was such a fun read. This
was I such know.
A fun book.
It is. Well, our parents, they stink, you know? Like, so it's like, it's fine. And I mean, seriously, you know, how many children's books start with adventures because they've lost their parents or.
It's so true.
You know, yeah. There was a comedian, I think, he, like a long time ago, used to do something about it, being like, because it's secretly every child's dream, you know, like your parents go away.
Yeah, it's hard to have adventures when you have a responsible parent who's like, no, you can't swim to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. And like that would have been me. And then just last week, here I am on the show telling people like not to go out your window when three talking cats in clothing like knock on it and ask you to come with them. You know, I'm like so boring and non-fun now.
Okay, I don't know how to switch from that to my book, but I will start talking about it anyway. And that is Cinema Love by Xiaoming Tang. And this is a book that follows gay Chinese men and the women they marry from 1980s China to 2020s Chinatown in New York City. So it starts with the 1980s, where closeted gay men secretly meet in the screening room of Maui City Workers Cinema as war films played. This was kind of the secret place that they could find each other and have a bit of a community and a bit of a meeting place. And the other main character, Bao Mei, sold tickets at the theater, which is where she met Old Second, who would eventually be her husband, and even though he's gay. So they have this respite in the cinema where Bao Mei is having her own affair with the projectionist, but that can't last forever. And basically, everything falls apart. They both are in a really difficult situation, and they decide to get married and immigrate to the U.S. together. And the book follows them as they struggle to adapt to life in New York City, and as the past threatens to upend everything they've built, even decades later and across an ocean. And we also see from some other immigrants from China. So we meet Yan Hua, who immigrates to the U.S. as a puppet wife for a man called Frog, and she is haunted by the ghost of her first husband. So this promises to be a moving and haunting read about loneliness, desire, immigration, and secrets. And that's Cinema Love by Xiaoming Tang.
Okay. So my last pick, I'm just going to rattle it off really quick for you because we've spent a lot of time talking about books already. It is actually a book that's coming out in paperback today. It was one of my very favorite books of last year, and I feel like just deserves more attention. It's Beyond That, The Sea by Laura Spence Ash. It's historical fiction set partly during World War II about a teen girl named Beatrix. She lives in London with her parents. They are not very well off. And when the bombing starts in the city, her parents make the difficult decision to send her to stay with a family in America. If this is sounding familiar, that is because I talked about it when it came out in hardcover, but seriously, I'm telling you about it again. And so Bea goes to stay with this glamorous family, the Gregorys in Maine, who have two sons around her age. And as time goes by, she begins to feel like she's always been a part of the Gregory family. Like, these parents are her parents. She forgets about her parents and life in London. You know, terrible things are happening during the war over there. She's not writing as frequently. She, you know, she doesn't think of them as often. But eventually the war ends and she has to return and try to adjust to life in England again. And then the book jumps years ahead and we meet her as an adult and what her life became after she left Maine. And she is reunited with one of the Gregorys. It's sad. It's beautiful. There are so many novels set during World War II that sometimes I'm just like, I don't want to read one right now. But I was so glad that I picked this up because it's an amazing debut that has just stayed with me. Content warnings do include mentions of child abuse and sexual assault off page, body shaming, war, trauma and grief, substance use and abuse, infidelity, and loss of a loved one. It is Beyond That, The Sea by Laura Spence Ash, out today in paperback.
All right. And my last book I want to talk about is Death's Country by R.M. Romero. And this is a premise that has a lot going on. So this is a queer, polyamorous, Latine YA retelling of Orpheus and Eurydice set in Miami, told in verse. So Its main character is Andre, who drowned in a river in Sao Paulo 1 year ago, but it didn't stick because he made a deal with death and now he has a new start. And his parents moved them to Miami, but they're continuing to endlessly fight with each other, which is really hard on him. He tries to escape through music. And then one day on the beach, he meets Renee and Leora, and they hit it off and become a polyamorous triad. They're really happy in their relationship, even if no one else understands it. But then Leora is in a car accident and ends up in a coma, and Andre feels like he's about to lose everything. But Renee is not giving up that easily. She has an idea, which is that the two of them will descend into the underworld, find their girlfriend's spirit, and reunite it with her body. Navigating the city of the dead is difficult enough, but there's one other complication, which is that when Andre died, he left a part of himself behind in the underworld, and it's something he never wanted to see again, but it wants to reunite with him. So this sounds so intense and interesting if you like Greek mythology retellings, especially queer and polyamorous retellings, or magical realism, or YA novels in verse. This definitely seems like one you should pick up. I don't think I've read a premise that is so interesting and compelling to me in a while. There's just so much going on, and all of it sounds really interesting. So I do want to give some content warnings for abuse, suicide, eating disorders, self-harm, and gore. And that is Death's Country by R.M. Romero.
Okay. So today, May 7th, or, you know, when we're talking about books for May 7th, you could be listening to this, you know, in the future. I don't know. There is like the biggest new release day of the year so far. There are a gazillion books out today. There are so many books out in paperback. I'm going to tell you about a few of them very quickly, starting with Beware the Woman by Megan Abbott. This is a thriller about a young wife who is pregnant, and she goes with her husband to visit his father for the first time. His father lives in the middle of the woods, and he's not a great person, and bad things are going to happen. Rouge by Mona Awad, author of Bunny and All's Well, as well as other books. This is a literary horror about beauty and mortality. The Postcard by Anne Barris and translated by Tina Cover. This is actually based on the author's family, in which a postcard was sent to her home that had the names of her great-grandparents and their children who died in the camps during World War II, and they're trying to find out who sent this postcard. Death Valley by Melissa Broder, about a woman who runs away to the desert to escape the pain and illness in her life and finds a cactus that isn't supposed to be growing in California that also happens to have a door in it, and so she decides to go through it. Little Monsters by Adrian Broder. This is about family secrets on Cape Cod. Penance by Eliza Clark. This fantastic book, one of my favorites of last year. It's about the murder of a teen girl who was killed by her friends, and now an author has come to town many years later and is writing a true crime book about it. It is one of the most difficult books I read last year. It's just like reading actual true crime, but it's so compelling and fantastic. The Guest by Emma Klein, author of The Girls. This is about a young woman who is staying on Long Island, and she gets kicked out of the house by the man she was staying with, and so she wanders around Long Island on Memorial Day weekend and the events that occur while she's doing that. The Ferryman by Justin Cronin, author of The Passage trilogy. This is about a group of survivors on a hidden island utopia that might not turn out to be so great. The Trap by Catherine Ryan Howard, about a woman trying to find out what happened to her sister who went missing, along with several other women. She suspects a serial killer, and she wants to know where her sister is. On Earth as It Is on Television by Emily Jane. This is like one of my favorite paperback covers. I adore this cover. It has a cat on it, so like you probably could have guessed that before I even said it, but I just love it. It's about first contact and how it affects the people on Earth. I haven't read this yet, but I was just reading that Edgar Cantero calls it a 2020s white noise, so now I'm going to like have to bump it up in my TBR. Happiness Falls by Angie Kim, another one of my favorite books of last year. It's a family drama and mystery about the father of a family who goes missing And the only one who was there when it happened is his son, who doesn't speak. So they have to figure out what happened. Translation State by Anne Leckie. Anne Leckie is like the bazillion award-winning author of the Ancillary Justice trilogy. This is a hard sci-fi tale about a missing translator. And You Are Here by Karen Lynn Greenberg, about life and tragedy in a small town in upstate New York revolving around the closing of a mall. So those are books that we have read, that we're excited about, that we really, really did like, despite what it sounded like. Danica, what are you going to read next?
I'm going to read Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl by Andrea Lawler, which is a queer shapeshifter book I've been meaning to read for a long time. I'm like a chapter in thinking, maybe this is too cool for me. I don't know.
I get it. I think it's a great book.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. I'm hoping to, well, first I'm going to finish Women and Children first because, oh, so good. And then hoping to read Highway 13, which are stories by Fiona McFarlane, who wrote a book that I love called The Night Tiger. And also this mystery that I barely know anything about, but it sounded really cool, called Word Hunter by Stella Sands. So that is what I'm going to read. And that is it for us today, book lovers. You can visit mytbr.co/gift to give the gift of TBR. That's mytbr.co/gift. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to our awesome audio editor, Caitlin Brame. You can drop us a line at allthebooks@bookriot.com. Danica, where can people find you online?
They can find me at Our Queer Shelves, ourqueershelves.substack.com. What about you?
I mostly hang out on Instagram. I haven't been posting much lately. I just go on and like look at Celtics things, but I'll get back to it. But if I go on Instagram, it is at @FranzenComesAlive. And if you want to give us a treat, you can go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever it is you get your podcasts and leave a rating or review. It helps other book lovers to find us, and we thank you so much. And as much as we would love to tell you about more books out today, we just don't have the time, but you can read about more titles out now in the show notes at bookriot.com/allthebooks, as well as find a link to our weekly new books newsletter, which I also write and fill full of books. And for more recs or general bookishness, check out bookriot.com. And don't forget to check out our full stable of podcasts at bookriot.com/listen, or just search Book Riot on your podcast player of choice. And in the meantime, happy reading.